Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why Would You Tell Me That, a podcast with him, Neil Delamere, me, Dave Moore, and you, the Why Would You Tell Me That listenership. See that, Neil? I'm including everybody. This is like part of our new strategy for 2024.
Wow, okay. So that whole dismissive make those bitches come to you thing that you've been doing for years on the radio
hasn't worked. Yeah. Podcast. I think we need to open our arms to the public. A filthy, unwashed public.
Those dirty masses. The filthy hoi polloi, and then he spits in the ground afterwards. I say bitches to include all genders, by the way.
Of course.
Like, you have to try and explain that sometimes to people outside of Ireland. When we say lads.
Oh, lads.
Lads means everybody, by the
way. I get complaints into the radio station. I work on a radio show and I'd say, you know, start the show and I go, morning, lads, what's the crack? Welcome along to the show. Who wants to win this? Let's do this, whatever. And then, now, probably twice a year, you get a complaint. I feel excluded because Dave said lads.
But lads, like, means everything in Ireland.
It means it's Ireland. We're Irish, like.
Yeah. All bets are off. That's all I'm going to say.
I could walk into a petting zoo as the lone human and go, yeah, lads! And every sheep, rabbit, kitten, peacock, turkey in the place would turn around and go, rrr! And I go, yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah. God, that sounded like a weird confession. It sounded like you were trying to get something off your chest. Dr. Doolittle, stroke man who spent too much time.
I don't stroke anything though since the ban, Neil. And I don't want to get anything off my chest. In fact, if anything, would you pile another yaw on my chest? I put another one on. I want to feel the weight of them. Another one on. Have you a ram in the van? Have you a ram?
If anything, it's a heavy petting zoo when I get involved. Yeah, they love it. The eyes the peacock does be giving me, hundreds of them, all winking at the same time. I don't know why we become dirty Dubliners.
I don't know either. Yeah, I've no excuse. I'm already a dirty Dubliner. I don't know why I do it, but sometimes it just comes out.
Will you just drag me down to your level?
Yeah, true. Here, listen, I should say a couple of things. Number one is you should get in touch with us. We are at Neil Delamere Comedy, at Dave Today FM, and at Why Would You Tell Me That on Instagram. We love hearing from you. We get so many messages when we do episodes and put them out with people who are loving this bit and that bit, and they get tickled by old stuff and new stuff, whatever. And also a lot of people suggest things, which is amazing. And the odd time we should give a shout out to formerly known as Twitter, also sometimes known as X, that Elon Musk right-wing hellhole that is X. We are at WWYTMT, the initials for Why Would You Tell Me That on that. So if you ever want to hit us up on that, you can also get us on that. Plus, we all have our own socials. So we're everywhere. We're part of the Acast Creator Network, and we love doing this podcast. Neil today,
yes,
is going to wow me and you and all of us with something amazing. What you got?
In part two, we're going to chat to Professor Luke O'Neill.
Oh.
About the history of the brain.
Now, for a lot of our Irish listeners, they'll hear Luke O'Neill and go, oh, the pandemic guy. But yeah, for a lot of our international listeners, they won't have a clue. But like Luke O'Neill, this is like, I mean, is this the Maradona of the scientific community? I mean,
if Maradona was the second most cited footballer, in
behind
Europe.
Behind Pele, obviously. Yeah,
he was Professor Lucanilla was the second most cited scientist in certainly in Europe for a few years. A professor of biochemistry in Trinity, brilliant science communicator. I've done a TV show with him even before he was famous, and he is going to explain how building the railroad and something that went wrong there explained how the mind works to us.
Okay, right.
See that for a stretch?
Why would you tell me that? I like it. Amazing.
So you said that people have gotten in touch. That is what part one is going to be about. So I should say, by the way, for our dear listeners, Dave Moore finally got off his well-rounded and beautifully shapely hoop the other day and went to see me do stand-up a couple of weeks ago, didn't you?
Can I tell you something there now? I thought there that Neil, as now, you know, over the years of certainly doing this podcast and working on projects before that, Neil has become one of my dear friends. He's someone I deeply enjoy spending time with, although a lot of it is virtual like this. And I thought when you started this, a bit of the conversation where you paused your episode to say something important about me.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say that Dave has broken all of the records in the radio listenership, that he has achieved something that many thought impossible, that you are so proud of him. That he has ventured out on his own and is overachieving. But yeah. No, you want to make the point that I finally went and saw you do stand-up.
Yeah, absolutely. You cannot slag me off about doing me introducing Countdown at the drop of a hat when you have shamelessly plugged. I love the way you say that many people thought was impossible. Like, people are sitting around thinking that it's like the Wright brothers will never fly. That all the best scientists in the world and all the philosophers, when it was even called natural science, were sitting there thinking, well, I don't know if over 230,000 listeners is even possible in Ireland, for Christ's sake. What a level. That's a level of self-regard that even a comedian can only look at and applaud. That is absolutely fantastic. Yes, Dave, congratulations. Dave has smashed all records. He has the biggest commercial radio show in Ireland and he never mentions it at all. I am very proud of you. Very well done.
Well, I am also massively proud of you because I did finally get up off my hole and go and see Neil Delamere do comedy. It wasn't some long conspiracy where I was actively trying to avoid it. It just was a coincidence of needs that never occurred until when I did get off my hole. I drove into town. I went for a gorgeous pizza beforehand and then went into the wonderful venue that is Vicar Street in Dublin. If anybody has ever been there, you'll know how good it is. If anybody ever gets the chance, go and see anybody do anything in Vicar Street. But if you get the chance, go and see Neil Delamere, because
you slightly undercooked the compliment there by saying essentially it's the power of the venue. Go and see anybody doing anything there. Neil, it was all right, but I saw a man paint it when actually it was closed, and such is the power of the topography of the actual seats, the ceiling height. Oh, that's the real winner of this. Thank you very much, Dave. Dave goes into the Louvre and doesn't look at the Venus de Milo or Mona Lisa. He looks at the walls and the structure around. Oh, look at the way that fire extinguisher hangs just under the
You could put one
sign.
Of my toddler's terrible crayon drawings up there and it would look great, is effectively what much. I've said about your comedy show.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I bring it up mainly because I got a text after it, because it does actually tie in to this week's episode of Why Would You Tell Me That? So I got a text after it said, this is right up your street, right? Now, you may know I like a bit of cycling. I love
you
a little
do,
bit of cycling.
You love
right?
cycling, yeah.
And I would argue that they are the toughest athletes on the planet. And my cousin was saying, nah, it's more jockeys. And my argument was, no, well, cycling is much more effortful, because when you sometimes see a jockey falls off the horse and the horse continues.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I have never, ever seen a fella fall off a bike and the bike then continues to win first place in the Tour de France. So somebody heard me say this and he said, have you heard of Frank Hayes? So this is part one of the show. Have you ever heard of Frank Hayes?
No.
He goes, this is right up your street. 4th of June, 1923, at New York's Belmont Park, the race course. Frank Hayes, he's 22, or according to some reports, he's even older than that. He could be in his 30s. He won the only race of his career on the horse Sweet Kiss.
Okay.
Now, what is remarkable about this is, how do I put this? He was dead.
Sweet Kiss or Frank?
Well, Sweet Kiss being dead is even more remarkable than Frank being dead. Riding a dead horse. I mean, flogging a dead horse is the phrase. Riding a dead horse to win in Belmont is Belmont Park is not the phrase.
So Frank Hayes won a race while he was dead.
Yeah, for Shea Boss, he was Marv. To our non-Irish listeners, he was dead.
Now, was this some kind of equestrian weekend at Bernie's where there was a load of lads sniggering in the paddock going, here, just drop them on there, drop them on there, put them around, see what happens, and we'll all take photos in 1930, whatever. Or did something terrible happen to Frank mid-race?
Well, I mean, he did die mid-race, so he was, oh. Yeah, it wasn't weekend at Bernie's, all right. He was from Brooklyn, and he was a stable hand turned stand-in jockey, and it was 20 to 1. Which, if you read the newspaper articles, it went, it was 20 to 1. And you're going, as if that is the most outlandish thing that happened in this horse. I mean, that is an unusual victory over the fan favourite Gimme. But I would suggest a man winning a horse race while he is no longer living.
Yeah.
Deceased, he is an ex-jockey, as the Monty Python lads would say. Yeah, so he tumbled from the saddle afterwards, and the track doctor ran over. His name was John A. Voorhees, and examined him, and he said, no, he thought he had suffered a heart attack.
And was there any kind of post-mortem? Do we know? Are we just assuming it was? I mean, it must have been something like that.
Well, there were suggestions that said, you know, he was so excited by the race and the adrenaline and all the rest, but there was other suggestions saying that he had lost so much weight. Of course, it's so dangerous to do that. In a very short space of time, that obviously that would have weakened his system. Yeah. And it's believed that Sweet Kiss, the horse, never raced again. And lore says that it was then called Sweet Kiss of Death.
Oh my God.
This is the kind of folklore that built up around this. But even 95 years later, it's not clear exactly when he died.
But he did. He started the race alive.
Alive.
And finished the race dead.
Yes.
Jeepers.
Yeah.
Now, questions. And maybe you have the answers, maybe you don't. Right.
Yeah.
Obviously, jockeys put their feet in stirrups.
Yes.
Obviously, they hold on to reins.
Yes.
I'm assuming, and I could be wrong about this, if you were to expire, your grip would loosen, your feet's position, the position of your feet in the stirrups would relax, and surely you would tumble. How did he stay on?
I don't know. I would imagine that it must have happened very shortly
before the end. Right.
By the way, this wasn't a flat race.
He was jumping.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that as well at the time.
Okay. Well, then he must have literally expired on the home straight.
Yeah. Yeah. This is in the Guinness Book of Records, or whatever it's called now, the Guinness World Records Book, or, you know, it's called some bizarre.
God, calm down. It's fine, whatever they call it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, my mistake sort of jumped out a bit there.
Oh, God, they've added in possibly one word, or maybe they haven't.
They want to slightly change the word order. They know how much I hate change. So, yeah, but he's in, according to the Guinness Book of Records, or the Guinness World Records website, he's the only person who's ever won a horse race while dead.
You have invented a rather macabre but interesting sport of strapping Weekend at Bernie's people to horses and see what happens. I mean,
now, you just something. You're a radio DJ. Now, let's be honest with the listeners here. Yeah. You're very successful, so therefore you don't have to resort to stunts. However, you know that sometimes, I'm not naming any names, DJs have resorted to breaking world records as a stunt. And I'm suggesting, if your book falls next week, you're going to be leading a horse into a hospice. And I think some of me really wants to see that, and some of me doesn't.
Well, first of all, I don't know what you're talking about, radio DJs who have some kind of stunt world records. I refer everybody to episode 1 of Why Would You Tell Me That to hear what my world record is. Please go and have a listen.
Ah, we have to tell them. Go on.
I blew a Malteser with a straw 24 feet across the floor of St. Stephen's Green Shopping Centre in Dublin, and have the plaque on my wall ever since.
Yeah.
to say that I am a world record holder.
Not all plaques have any dignity attached to them in any way, shape, or form. It's like a plaque on a doorway that says Adolf Hitler used to live here at some point.
No, it isn't at all.
That's
by
exactly
the way,
like that. It's exactly the same.
There's a great story I covered on my award-winning record-breaking radio show, which was that a French lad called Richard, decided he wanted to break the Guinness World Record for building an Eiffel Tower replica out of matchsticks.
Okay.
So for an 8 or 9 years, his front room was made up of boxes of matches and him putting them together and creating, obviously, lots of little bits, because this thing is 7 meters tall.
Right.
7 meters tall, right?
Okay, so 22 feet tall.
Yeah, so you're talking about, like, it could only exist fully assembled inside a giant sports hall. Like, obviously couldn't go in his living room because his living room is about 2 meters tall.
Yeah.
So he had to assemble all the bits and took him 8 or 9 years. And his missus was obviously getting understandably ratty about this.
Yeah.
But he eventually got it made. He assembled it in the sports hall and he rang the Guinness World Record lads. And they just asked him a couple of questions and then went, nah, it's not a record. And he went, no, it is, because the lad who did it before was only 5 meters something. I'm 7 meters. He's like, yeah, but what happened was you got bored of trying to stick the matches with the little red tip. What's that, phosphorus or something, whatever it is that makes matches go.
Yeah.
So you contacted the match company. You asked the match company for specific boxes without the little lighty ignitey bit. Which is just a stick, and they are not commercially available, and your record is null. You get nothing. Good day, sir. Good day.
And they found this out?
Yeah, because he had to submit, like, you know, a sample of what he built with and whatever. And they just went, nah.
But he does have the record for mixed used specialist matches replica of the Eiffel Tower.
Don't give records away for anything. You a record and think you're going to get it and get a certificate on your wall. I mean, come
on. The sad thing is, why he also didn't need to smoke all those cigarettes to justify buying the matches. He now has emphysema and no record. It's horrendous. Let me ask you another thing. Okay, let's move on from the world of betting and horse racing to actual contracts, because, you know, bet isn't actually a contract. If I sent you a text and said, we're doing this live podcast next month for this much money at this venue.
I mean,
maybe Vicar Street, if you love it so much. And you sent me a thumbs up emoji back.
Yeah.
What would that mean? Would that mean you just received the contract? Thanks for sending it. Or would that mean, yep, I agree to the contract?
What I'm worried about now is that you send me a lot of text messages. And yes. I'm a very busy, successful radio DJ, world records kind of guy. So I respond with a thumbs up to you quite a lot. Not out of disrespect. As I said before, you were a dear friend.
Yes.
But I do occasionally have to answer you in between things. I also have 4 children.
Yeah.
I'm a busy man. If you now assume that me sending you a thumbs up on a text message is some kind of binding contract, then I think I'm already in trouble before you even go on.
I want you to look at your front door. I own your house now. There is a notice of eviction. All of your children are mine. And
you're welcome to them.
No. I'm going to put them in, you know, the bit of the Matrix where they're just being harvested, just in case any of them match me, organ-wise or blood.
Battery power for his electric car, I get it.
Anything at all. If there's a little bit of lithium in those bad boys, we're extracting it immediately, and your thumbs up has agreed. Well, there was a court case to decide if a thumbs up emoji is contractually binding.
Oh my
God. Like a signature. So it's in Canada. It's in Saskatchewan. A grain buyer with Southwest Terminal sent a mass text message to all his clients in March 2021. This was only decided now in 2023, right?
Right.
Advertising that he was looking for 86 tons of flax.
Okay, sorry. I was confused. I thought you said graham buyer. And I was like, who buys 86 tons of grahams? Are they? You said grain.
Grain.
Sorry.
Grain.
Sorry. Gotcha.
So this is in Canada, okay? So the buyer, Kent Mickleborough, of course his name is Kent Mickleborough.
Kent, yeah.
What a great name.
What a Kent.
He spoke with this farmer, this guy's called Chris Actor, right, on the phone. And he texted a picture of the contract to deliver the flax in November, asking the farmer to please confirm flax contract in the message, right? So Actor goes, thumbs up emoji, right?
Yeah.
But he didn't deliver the flax in November. And by that time, the prices for the crop had increased. So basically, Mickleburgh goes, well, no, you said thumbs up. That means that you'd agreed the contract. And Acton went, no, that's not what thumbs up means. That I just meant that I got the contract.
Oh,
I just got the text message in the contract.
Right. But at what point was Acton going to take after his name and act upon the sent contract? Because, like, if he's not responding with, I'm not signing this, then surely the assumption that the thumbs up means I've signed and I agree to this is actually correct.
Well, the Canadian judge ruled that the thumbs up emoji is just as valid as a signature.
Yes!
Arguing the courts need to now adopt to the new reality.
Wow!
Yeah, and the lads were like, apparently actors' lawyers were going, well, you know, if this is a thumbs up, well, I mean, what does a fist bang emoji mean? You know, what does that mean?
And yeah.
He just kind of opened it up to, well, I mean, I've been sent an aubergine and a peach. I think I've married someone. I'm not really sure what's going on here at all. And but the judge went, no, get a thumbs up. And this is how sad I am. I was looking up the court's judgment the other day, and they had to put in a thumbs up emoji in their court
judgment. In the court
document. There's a load of pictures of the thumbs up in the actual judgment.
The only thing I'll say is, right, if I walked up to you in real life with a small peach and a large aubergine or eggplant, as some of our listeners will call it, and I went, like, you know, I motioned the eggplant towards the aubergine or towards the peach, you may look at me and go, what do you mean? Or if I, like, you know, lay on the ground and squeeze tears out of my eyes while maniacally laughing, you know, these are some of the emojis that we're familiar with and use regularly, but they're not universal human communications, which a thumbs up absolutely is. Like, it's got history, it's got weight, it's got, you know, it pretty much means good job in most of certainly Western society. It means, yeah, positive, got it, great, everything's cool, like.
And it's two lads from the same part of the world. So there isn't any sort of cultural, you know, they can't say, well, hold on.
Yes.
That guy's from Canada. I'm from Africa. That guy's from Japan. I'm from.
Yeah. Exactly.
The Seychelles. So, yeah. So the judge went, okay, this is, you're going to have to pay him. And the farmer was ordered to pay 82,000 Canadian dollars or 61,000 US dollars for an unfulfilled contract.
Wow.
So stop sending me thumbs up when you don't mean it.
What about the gif of the guy who points at the side of his head and winks? Like, I constantly send that to everyone. Like,
yeah,
what does
well,
that
you
mean?
Send that to me, and that means that you are duty bound to come here to my house tomorrow and try the scents that we agreed for our perfume line. So why would you smell me that?
Oh my God, why would you smell me that is the greatest name of anything ever. Yes, Neil Delamere.
I cannot believe this is how we come up with our merch business ideas.
Incredible.
We abuse each other for long enough that a pun creates an iconic product.
Why would you fail me that for our tree services?
Why would you spell me that for our wizardry?
Why would you well me that for our water divination services?
And if we'll bottle that water, what does it do? Why would you quell me that? That stops our thirst.
This is so good.
Our alarm system, why would you bell me that? This, oh my God. In fact, these are better podcast ideas than this one.
They are. My town crier company, why would you yell me that?
Yes. Oh, our clairvoyant one, why would you foretell me that?
You've added an extra syllables now. It's even better. This is wonderful.
We're such children.
Yeah.
Let's talk to an adult in part two. We will talk to Professor Luke O'Neill about the history of the brain and why something that happened during, well, the building of the railroads in America gave us an insight into how your mind actually works.
How do we get professors on?
Because I tell them it's a different show.
Okay. That's okay.
Why would you missell me that?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to Why Would You Tell Me That Part 2. Now, I met our next guest when he was a mere slip of a lad as a panellist on the Comedy Science Show I hosted, Dave. I like to call it the smallest BMW because it was one series long. I didn't know he was one of the most eminent scientists the country has ever produced at that point. And I'm not joking here.
He,
at one point, was the second most cited scientist in Europe. And he became a household name. And he's also conveniently very tall. So myself, PJ Gallagher, and Luke O'Neill, Professor Luke O'Neill, once did the ascent of man by standing in the correct order. It is Professor Luke O'Neill. How are you, Luke?
Not too bad, Neil. I've got fond memories of that. Yeah, the three of us standing there. Wasn't it tremendous, you know? And why didn't they commission more series? I thought it was very funny, Neil. What was wrong with them?
I think the issue might be the host, Luke, I'll be honest with you. You know, you get all the best guests, and then unfortunately... It just comes down to the talent, really, that's there to corral them all. And sometimes
spoken like a true parasite, always blames the host. So there's so much in your latest book, right, which is called To Boldly Go Where No Book Has Gone Before. We'll ignore the split infinitive, the famous split infinitive. Dave is very, he's a grammar Nazi.
Is he picky?
Oh, mother of God, you wouldn't believe it.
The amount of hyphens I have to put into Neil's text when he sends them, I'll just send them back to him correctly with the correct lexicon.
Very stressful. And then,
yeah,
the only man I've ever seen grammatically correct a fucking emoji. My favorite chapter is the one I think we're going to focus on today. I told Dave in part one, we are going to do the history of the mind.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, there's a lot in it. But let's start with at the beginning with the Egyptians, who were very good at lots of things, didn't really put a huge amount of import on the brain, did they?
No, they didn't, surprisingly, Neil. They used to pull the brain out from the nostrils and throw it away. They thought the brain was an irrelevancy entirely. You know, they thought that all the emotions were in the heart, you see, which does make a bit of sense, I suppose, given that your heartbeat goes up. But the Egyptians get the credit, actually, for doing the first kind of biology, in a way, you know. And in a different chapter, I talk about the history of biology. They were the first to dissect people, or mummies, you know what I mean, and prepare embalming and all that. But for some reason, they missed the brain. They thought the brain was a pink mush that wasn't really interesting.
Yeah? I thought that thing of pulling brains out through the nose was a kind of an urban legend or whatever. So it's actually true.
It's true. In the embalming process, you see, they would get rid of the brain because it rots, you know.
So yeah.
Embalming meant about preserving the body, obviously. And again, wow. They put great store in the heart. You know, that was their idea at that time.
But the Greeks were a little bit better. So the Greeks were thinking, well, it might be in the mind, might be in the brain, it might be in the heart. But as usual, Hippocrates comes along, as in Hippocratic Oath, and he thinks, well, it's in the brain. And based on something fairly logical, really.
Well, you can't beat the Greeks, can you, for so many things, you know. And he said, well, look, the eyes and your ears and your sense are up in your head.
Yeah.
So therefore, the brain must be picking up stuff off the senses, which makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And he was right, of course. The eyes plug into the brain, so do the ears. Obviously, this your hearing and your all your senses are up in that part of your body, you know. So Hippocrates got it right. He had no real evidence for this, of course. He just thought the proximity must have made the brain the place where all the action is.
Let's skip ahead a little bit. Dave, let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
When do you think the first I don't know how to describe this. When do you think the first man, first physician, to tie off the temporal lobe or temporal? Let me ask that question entirely again.
This is not.
Is it during this question? Is it during this question? Okay, let me ask you this. I'll ask it properly. When do you think the first physician tied off the temporal artery?
I think it was 3:15. I would imagine, given how little even the Greeks understood the brain, I would say we are talking modern medicine. So I will say late 1800s.
What if I go the 10th century, Dave?
No, there's no way.
There is, yeah. 10th century. Luke?
Yeah, an Arab physician, Dave. Now, you see, the Arab scientists were well ahead of the Europeans in this time, as you may know. In Europe, we were mainly copying out the Bible. That was the best activity we had, our learned people.
Yeah.
The Arab scientists were discovering all kinds of things, like chemistry. Alchemy came from the Arab
zero. The Arabs discovered zero, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of good physicians. And this guy, Al-Zahrawi is his name, he had a terrible migraine. And he thought, oh, it's too much blood going into my head.
Oh.
So he tied off the cerebral artery to stop the blood flow into his head. On his own head. And luckily it relieved the headache. Now, he dropped down dead. No, he didn't. But it seemed to relieve the... it seemed to relieve the... Migraine, as they are today, migraines are horrendous things. Anybody who's had one of them now, you know. And he was so desperate, he tied off the blood flow into his head. You see,
we don't recommend any listeners who do suffer, unfortunately, from migraines to do something of a similar nature. Not a good shout.
No, don't do this at home.
But I love this thing. Do you know when they find out that a folk remedy or something that you've a kind of a vague idea might work, then they find the scientific basis of this. So one of the ones famously was the cabbage leaves on boobs for if the nipples are cracked from breastfeeding. And then they figured out there was a compound in this that actually worked. But this is a similar thing. They have recently figured out, you know, relatively recently, how migraines are caused. And
yeah.
It sounds like he wasn't that far off the mark.
He wasn't, Neil. And it's very much in my wheelhouse, shall we use that phrase? So what's happening there is you get what's called vasodilation. So blood vessels open up and the blood rushes in. Now, I work on inflammatory diseases. And in inflammation, blood vessels open up and it gets red and hot because all the blood is flowing in, you know. And there's these factors that cause blood vessels to open. And one of them has the great name, Dave, CGRP.
Okay.
That's made up in the head. Opens the blood vessels, all the blood rushes in, and then you get a migraine. And now the latest drugs to treat migraine block CGRP. And they're a massive advance. And anybody with migraines will be on a CGRP inhibitor, as we call them. And it really seems to work. So that Arabic physician got it right, basically, all those hundreds of years ago.
In the 10th century. And you can actually confirm or deny this wives' tale that I saw recently and sent to my friend who suffers from migraines. She fortunately has not had a migraine to test it yet, but exactly that, vasodilation. So yeah. The theory is that because you want the blood to come away from the brain, so the idea is that you fill a bucket with the hottest water you can stand and put your feet in it. As a result, the vasodilation will happen in your feet, the blood will go away from the brain, and it may alleviate the migraine. Any logic to that at all?
Dave, are you a reincarnated Arab physician? Is that what you're doing then? That's exactly what it is, probably.
No way.
Now, I suspect the pain off the hot water distracts.
Would also distract, yeah. Yeah.
I never know.
Al Dave is what we're going to call him for the rest of this. Have you heard? I know you have heard. If I asked, who is your favorite French philosopher, Dave? Who would you say?
The Senegalese French rapper MC Solar is not going to be the correct answer you want. Oh, so, I'd imagine
he's number
towards,
two.
He's number two. I'd imagine leaning towards René Descartes.
Oh, now we're talking.
That is exactly who. This dude is my favorite person in the entire book, right?
Right.
Because he's the person a lot of people will have heard of, but what a life. In 1619, he has a bout of one of the finest named conditions known to man, and it is called, look at Neil,
exploding head syndrome. And it's real, Neil. It is actually a real clinical syndrome. Yeah.
So what is it?
Well, at its worst case, you think you hear a massive explosion. As you're falling off to sleep, you suddenly hear a massive explosion, right? And then you wake up with a shriek. And the milder ones are called myoclonic jerks. You ever jerk when you're falling? I don't mean that now, Dave. Jerk. I'm saying you ever jerk when you're falling asleep? That's kind of on this spectrum, exploding head syndrome. It's basically a massive muscle spasm, and you can hear this massive explosion. And some people literally hear like a bomb going off. You know, and Descartes was one of those people who suffered from this.
But he thought that they led to some degree of inspiration, though, didn't he?
Well, as I'm saying, Descartes said that it was when his head was exploding, that's when he was most inspired about mind-body dualism, is what he's famous for, as you probably know. He thought that the mind and the body were quite distinct things, you know? And then he also said, I think, therefore I am. That was his great phrase, which is a bit obvious, I suppose. But he was inspired, as in fact many scientists are in the book. Strangely, scientists dream their next discovery. It's a very peculiar thing. We think it's because you're thinking about it hard all day.
I was just going to say, surely the brain has been working on whatever the problem is. And then as it's processing that, you must get some kind of inspiration.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in this chapter, you know, I'll jump ahead. So a guy called Lowy, L-O-E-W-I, he dreams about what are called neurotransmitters, which are signals in the brain. He got that in a dream, right? Wow. And the trouble is he dreamt it. And he wrote it down and went back to sleep. And he couldn't read his own handwriting the next day. Right? And he spent the whole day worrying. And he dreamt again, the same thing the next night. And he
came up with
him. Yep. So there's another example of a dream that's highly productive.
Phenomenal. Have you ever dreamed up a brilliant equation or a brilliant experiment to do to prove something?
No. Sadly, I haven't. Now, you would appreciate one of the few jokes in the book. My dreams are normally me standing naked in front of a bunch of students holding a monkey. That's one of my dreams.
See, I read that and I don't think that's a joke at all.
It's true.
I think it's 100% true. And I only wish that people could see this Zoom call because he's completely in the nip. He's bollock naked. He's got a massive Planet of the Apes poster behind him.
I'm holding up I'm a cack monkey in my hand as we speak.
Now I know why the second season of Neil's show was cancelled, because this was the pitch for episode one of season two.
Can I just say, you got to be careful if you're ever in Belfast, just pick a different sort of monkey, because if you ever go, I've got macaque in my hand, that is an entirely different
yeah. Mind you, that's another dream, Neil, isn't it?
Yes, that's something entirely different. I don't think you need to be a scientist to dream that one.
So Descartes, right? Yes, he's exploding head syndrome, Dev. Like, he's brilliant. Not only do we know him because Cartesian planes and all that sort of stuff, and I think therefore I am, and he's writing about mind-body dualism. He goes off because he needs the money, doesn't he? And he goes off to Sweden and he starts to tutor none other than the Queen of Sweden, Queen Christina of Sweden, right?
Right.
But so he's doing well there. She likes his writings about love, but they disagree because he essentially has this other big theory that the universe is like a big machine. It's just to be understood. Mm. And they fall out. And then what happens?
But he's tutoring her in this freezing cold castle, you see, as well, at 5 a.m. every morning, which annoys him. And he catches pneumonia and dies because of all this.
Or does he?
That's the question there.
Oh.
Now, because he was a Catholic in a Protestant country, he's buried in a pauper's grave, you see.
Right.
Unmarked grave.
Yeah.
Fast forward a few years, the French aren't happy. They want his body back. So they exhume his body, right, out of the ground. And guess what? His skull is missing. They find his bones, but his skull is missing. And they put an Inspector Clouseau, I'm sure, type character on the case to try to find out what happened. And this guy discovers that in those times, there was a practice called skull blasting. Now, skull blasting is when a famous person's head is chopped off and you sell the skull as a collector's item.
Oh, my God.
Now, will Neil Delamere, how much will Neil's skull go for, Dave? That's the question. When he passes away.
Is it my skull as a child or my skull as an adult? You see, it depends. I reckon I could sell this bad boy several times over.
You probably could. But the thing was, the skull is eventually retrieved. They track it down. It had changed hands a few times. And it was a brewery owner buys it first, by the way.
Brilliant.
It ends up at a casino owner, can you believe it? And they retrieve the skull. Now, they knew it was Descartes' skull.
Yeah.
Every owner had carved on it their name.
No.
And they said, this is Descartes' skull, and I'm whatever my name is, and I own the skull. There were loads of these
carvings. So that was the original certificate of authenticity, except it was carved into the skull.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Do you know when you go on the Antiques Roadshow and they go, do you have any, what is the provenance of this? And it's just carved in the skull. Look at that. That skull looks like it had exploding head syndrome. Look at it. One of the guys who was in Sweden. Now, what Luke is saying is that he died of pneumonia. However, there is a suggestion that he may well have been poisoned by a Catholic clergyman because he was trying to convert. His teaching may have stopped the priest converting the Queen of Sweden to Christianity.
Right. There was a fear that she was going to convert under his influence, basically. Right. And they reckon it was, a communion wafer poisoned with arsenic that was given to him. There's some evidence for this, you see. So now, whether it's true or not,
Dave's blaming the host again.
Anyway, the bottom line is, the good part is that his skull is finally reunited with his bones.
Right.
And talk about mind-body dualism. This sort of, isn't it wonderful? The very man who came up with it had his head and his bones separated. Now they were reunited. And now his skeleton can now be seen in Paris, you know, restored to its former glory.
That's incredible. Wow.
So now we're in the position of, well, we know where we think the mind is in the brain, right? And we're writing about mind-body dualism. Now we have a man who's popped up on the show before, and this is what I like about the connections between this episode and previous other episodes. We have Galvani, right? Or Galvini, I should say, as in galvanized. So Susie Dent mentioned him because it's an eponym,
yeah.
And also Dave Moore, on one of the very first episodes of this show, covered Mount Tambora and the explosion thereof. So Galvini in 1780 discovers what, Luke, exactly?
He was messing around with frogs. Now, you might wonder why he'd mess around with frogs. But they were dissecting frogs and studying frogs' muscles and stuff, you know? And for some reason, he had a metal kind of piece of wire that he'd rubbed against some fur and had charge in it, you know? And he stuck that on the frog's leg and the frog's leg moved.
Okay. Right?
Now, at the time, this was absolutely mind-blowing because here was a dead creature that you could kind of bring back to life in a way, you know? And the frog's leg twitched. And that was Galvani's experiment, you know?
Incredible.
And that began the whole proper science of what nerves are and what the brain is made of.
Electrical
the brain
is
one
that.
Big electrical system, really, you know? So he gets the credit for opening up that vista, and it's all about electrical currents, really, you know?
And Neil, why are you bringing this down back to Tambora?
Because his research in the was published all over Europe at the time.
Yeah.
And who wrote the book about Frankenstein?
Shelley.
Ah, Shelley. Mary Shelley.
So Mary Shelley writes the book about Frankenstein, as we know, because she was essentially snowed in under bad weather or rained in bad weather in Switzerland, and they came up with ghost stories. But she would have been exposed to this research, possibly herself or possibly through the doctor that was in the group with them. And how was Frankenstein's monster brought to life? He was electrocuted.
That's right.
Incredible. Yeah. And she was only, what gets me is, Neil, she was only 18 years of age. Can you believe?
Yeah.
That's with Shelley, poet. I mean, I think, and Lord Byron is there, but Byron was a real ne'er-do-well. He's there with Shelley, and there's Mary. Can you imagine, you know?
Yeah.
And they're stuck indoors, and they had a competition to write the most terrifying ghost story. Now, what got me on her was, there was a local castle owned by a Frankenstein guy, right? Who had terrified the people hundreds of years before because of alchemy. So she knew about this name and the castle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The doctor, Poldori, probably told her about that he was up on the latest science kind of thing, you know. And next thing, she writes this, the first proper horror story, really, you know. And as you know, most science fiction horror stories are based on an accident in a lab, you know.
Yes.
Something gone bad. You know? And it was a terrifying book. She talks about taking material from the slaughterhouse, you know, using lightning to create the charge. And next thing, the Frankenstein monster emerges. And it's a fantastic work of art, isn't it? And science fiction. It's
unbelievable.
Great.
And when it went to the West End, like, it was a live show. Like, women fainted and were carried out. There's all sorts of conniptions and attacks of vapors happening as well. So I know we're skipping ahead here, but there's so much to cover. 1815, right? Florent, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes.
Florent in Paris. He creates lesions in the brains of living rabbits, Dave.
Okay.
Poor old living rabbits, but he wanted to prove something, and he ended up proving it. What parts of the brain essentially controlled what?
Well, they functions? Knew by then, if you take out a brain, it's got different bits to it. There's the hippocampus, and there's the brain stem, and the cerebellum. And they knew what do these do, you know? And this guy begins to use a knife to dig into them, basically, and he sees what's happening in the rabbits, you know? And he figures out that, you know, the cerebellum is where the muscles are going being activated
right.
by. The brain stem controls breathing. So if you cut through that, the rabbit dies quickly.
Right,
you know, this kind of thing. You know? And he figures out then gradually which bit of the brain is doing what. And that was called the localization theory. They gave it, of course, a great word. In other words, different parts of the brain do different things is the idea, you see. And that was the beginning of neuroanatomy, you might call it, is the term for this.
And he beat Victor Hugo, author of Les Mis, for a place in the Academy, was it?
He was made a member of the French Academy, which is the highest honour in France, you see. And there was a vote, him versus Hugo. Poor old Hugo didn't get the final vote.
Wow.
Fumon did, you know, which made him très miserable. Another joke in my book. Because
I would disagree with you that it is the ultimate honour in France, because allegedly when Victor Hugo died, the brothels of Paris entered a day of mourning and all the prostitutes, the sex workers wore black. This is the rumor.
That is the highest honor you can
that be is that is the highest honor in any country, but in France, ooh la la.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're figuring out and proving there's some sort of degree of electrical impulse and different parts of the brain control different functions, right?
Yep.
Then we get to, wow, what a story. Phineas Gage. What a great name, first of all, 1848.
Yeah.
Tell us what his job was, first of all, Luke.
Had you not come across that story before, Neil?
I had come across it before, but I didn't put two and two together. But the name is so famous that it had sat in my brain, ironically, for a while.
It's like Barnum and Bailey chariot. But he was working on the Hudson River Railroad in New York, right? And they were extending the railroad, and they were setting off explosives to cut, you know, through rock or whatever.
Yep.
And there was a method where you would bang a hole in a rock, put in some gel ignite, and then put in some sand over the gel ignite, and that would make the explosion go inside the rock, and it was a more effective way to put. And the thing they used to put the sand in was called a tamping iron. It was like an iron about this size. So there's old Phineas banging in the tamping iron, sets off the gel ignite, and the bolt went up through his eye, behind his forehead and out of his head, right? So it basically went right through his skull, taking some pink brain with it, by the way, and it lands a few feet away, and they could see his brain pulsating through the hole. You know, this kind of thing.
Oh, my God.
So he collapses and has an epileptic fit, understandably. You know, he's banged a metal rod through his brain.
Basically. Yeah.
And then he goes home and has a rest, and the local doctor comes to see him.
Sorry, he goes home and has a rest.
He was going to go back after his break or whatever, you know. And he says a great phrase.
You're over, Phineas.
Yeah. The doctor turns up and Phineas says to him, "Doctor, here is business enough for you." He says, "You know, that's a great understatement."
Yeah.
Now they notice pretty quickly Phineas begins to act a bit strangely.
Okay.
And he gets very impetuous and he loses his temper and all kinds.
Oh.
A massive personality change happens as a result of this.
Okay.
In other words, he goes from being a happy-go-lucky, whatever the personality types
temper,
are,
hammer.
I'm sure Neil knows the psychological subcategories of personality, but he goes from the happy-go-lucky, affable chap into a grouchy, miserable person, you know, simply because part of his brain had been knocked out.
Or maybe because he was shot through the head by a giant metal boat. I mean, you know, there's a couple of angles there as to why his personality might change.
I like the way he is simply because, as happens every day, he turns his own head into a kebab. He fires a metal bolt 25 meters through his head. And like you said, the witnesses said that there was gunk, basically his brain was on it. So,
yeah.
And he was a man who was conscientious, and he was, you know, he was always on time, and he paid great attention to his work, and then he became this irritable man. Obviously, he had this frontal lobe in.
Sounds exactly like Dave was the original Gage, and Neil is the post-Bolt Gage.
Oh,
you impetuous, ratty Midlander.
Jekyll and Hyde. Jekyll and Hyde.
There you go.
Okay. Oh, I'd like to argue with any of those points, but they're so accurate and well made. Also, he shares my love of the stage. Well, he did afterwards because he was hoofed out of his job. So what does he go and do? What do you think, Dave? What do you reckon?
Does he join a circus of, and forgive the 18th, 19th century title, does he join a circus of freaks?
That is exactly what he does.
No.
Barnum's famous one day. Barnum's American Museum. He was in Barnum's in New York, and he made a good living out of it. And of course, the way that was described was that was a museum, freaks of nature, which was seen there.
Yeah.
And there he was with his skull a bit open, you know, and they would reenact the thing.
Did reenact it?
Oh, yeah. Well, not directly.
No, obviously. Because at some point his head becomes like Swiss cheese and there's less and less brain to go through, I would have thought.
So he shot the bolt through his eye socket out the back of his brain.
Yeah.
A bit of his skull obviously would have been removed.
Yeah.
Presumably he'd lost sight in the eye. I don't know. Maybe he didn't. Yeah. But did they not cover or do something to repair the skull? How is it still open when he's in the circus?
They had a bandage over it. You see,
a bandage?
And you could, Dave, you could see the brain pulsating, you see, through the little hole.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, isn't that terrifying? But there you have it. He made good money out of this, showing the hole in his head, basically. He made a living.
But, like, he was famous. He had a limerick written about him.
He did. We've got to give the limerick, don't we?
Come on, hit me.
So, a moral man, Phineas Gage, tamping powder down holes for his wage, but with his special made probe through his left frontal lobe, now he drinks, swears, and flies in a rage.
That
captures
beautiful.
The whole story in a few lines, isn't it great?
Oh, that's incredible.
So I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but Ramon E. Cajal figured out that we have neurons. So he figured out that we have a cell body, that's what it would be called now, and these little nerve fibrous axons coming out of them. But there's gaps between these neurons. So that's the synapse, right?
That's right.
So you're trying to figure out, for many, many years, people were trying to figure out how, so the electrical impulse goes down your kind of broadband wire, but then it has to jump the gap. And they're trying to figure out what allows it to continue on along the next neuron. And they figured out it's a chemical. It's neurotransmitters, the ones we've all heard of.
Right.
That's right.
So like dopamine, serotonin, GABA, glutamate.
Yep, they're all there.
So what happens when you drink? What happens if you drink alcohol to glutamate, which is a neurotransmitter, and GABA, which is your neurotransmitter?
Well, again, the biochemists, my own profession, get involved and they start purifying these neurotransmitters and characterizing them, and they find glutamate. Now, glutamate goes up when you're anxious. It's an anxiety neurotransmitter, you see, and it goes up and down through anxiety. And it's natural to be anxious. We're evolved, especially in a social situation.
Yeah.
You're on your guard a bit, you know, that guy might kill you, whatever it is. So glutamate is elevated in the pubs, right? Now, if you drink alcohol, it suppresses glutamate.
Stop drinking in those really rough pubs, by the way. That fella might kill you. Jesus, Luke.
Well, it's the times, for me, it's the times we live in. Those antibiotics come after wherever I am. But the glutamate gets repressed and you feel better because the anxiety goes away.
Okay.
You know? But the trouble is it goes down very low. And then when you come off the alcohol the next morning, say, and the alcohol's gone, you get a rebound. The glutamate goes up too high.
Right.
And finally settles down again and back to normal. You know.
So hang on. Is elevated glutamate the fear?
Absolutely. Anxiety.
Oh, my God.
Anxiety. And even more impressively, another one, Neil Mitchell, GABA. GABA makes you feel relaxed. It's the opposite of glutamate. That goes up with alcohol. So very strangely. Right. Now, of course, alcohol was discovered randomly, you know, about thousands of years ago to have these beneficial. But now we know how it works. So it suppresses glutamate. Anxiety begins to say, GABA makes you relax. That goes up. But the trouble is you get a rewire, you know, the next morning, bang.
Yes.
And that's the fear. That's when you go, God. What sort of life am I living here? You know, in other words, you get a huge attack of the living horrors, I believe, as the Irish call them, right?
I don't know why you're looking at me. I've read about it, but so now we're getting to a point, and people have been very curious about not necessarily how the brain works, but how memories are formed, and what is the actual physical component of memories, and this would blow your mind, Dave. There's a man called Eric Kandel, an Austrian. He actually proved the molecular basis of memory.
Right.
This is kind of crazy. It's quite hard to explain, though. He was working with a sea slug, Luke, wasn't he?
Yeah, sea slug, yeah. I've met him actually, Jonas, a few times. He's a very famous guy in my business, you know. He picks the sea slug because it's only got 20,000 neurons. Our brains have billions of neurons.
Okay, right. Okay, complicated. So 20,000, right.
These little slugs, they have only 20,000 and they can learn amazingly. Now, how do you teach a slug? I don't know, but they can learn. It's called a repulsive reflex away from something dangerous.
Okay, yeah.
And they learn to recognize that and don't go near it. You know?
That slug might kill me. Yeah.
And he was able to figure out what was going on in the neurons of that slug. And in particular, a chemical called cyclic AMP goes up.
Okay.
And that was the message that said, lay down the memory. And if you stop the cyclic AMP, the slug can't learn that anymore, you know.
Right.
And that was the first time a real chemical was linked into memory. Now, as we've discussed before, the neurotransmitters were linked to things like pleasure, you know, the famous endorphins, dopamine is in motivation. Yeah. That had been worked out a bit, you know, some of that. And 5-HT serotonin is a mood regulator. That's why it's a target for antidepressants, you know. But the memory thing was completely unknown until Eric came along. And he gets the first memory molecule, as it were. Now, of course, what we still don't know, though, is what happens next. We don't know what happens next.
They also don't know where memories are necessarily stored, because with rats, they've, you know, taken this part of the brain out, this part of the brain out, this part of the brain out, and the rat's memory is Banjak's, essentially. So they think that memory might be stored across the various bits. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we know the hippocampus is probably the organizing center of it. And of course, the hippocampus is the bit that gets clogged in Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
With this thing called beta amyloid. It's a protein,
yeah.
A normal protein, actually, that for some reason starts to clog up the hippocampus. And we don't know why that is, but that begins to badly affect memory. So the hippocampus might organize it. But as Neil says, it probably is all over the brain, is somehow involved. You know?
Isn't there wonderful studies, and not for the creatures involved, but of caterpillars, where they have developed a fear in the caterpillar, much like maybe the repulsive kind of muscle movement. They've shown a caterpillar that this thing is bad for whatever reason. It always seems to be a negative thing. They can't go, this thing is good, whatever. But then the caterpillar forms a cocoon, turns into goo, metamorphosizes, whatever that verb is, into a beautiful butterfly. They bring the butterfly out and they go, here, look at that thing. And the butterfly goes, oh, no way.
Yeah.
And it knows, it remembers, and it was goo.
It's incredible. Yeah, that's the same kind of process, I suppose. You know, so whatever's going on there in that little brain, you know, it's able to remember things. I mean, it's the same as our brain.
But usually, there's these great, amazing experiments to kind of uncover knowledge for us. But a lot of the time, it is those accidents. It is the Phineas Gage type of things. The hippocampus one was another, well, I'm not saying accident, but it was a patient, was it in the 50s, Luke, who was having epileptic seizures as a kid, and they removed part of his hippocampus to see if they could fix that.
Exactly. Yeah. And what was amazing was the removal of his hippocampus. He could remember everything before the removal and nothing after. He could do crossword puzzles, get this thing, where the clues were based on stuff before the hippocampus was damaged. He could figure out the answer after he couldn't do the crossword anymore.
So you couldn't lay down new memory.
You couldn't lay down, exactly. Old memories. And again, that idea, that must have been spread all over his brain, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You damage hippocampus and you can't organize memories anymore. New memories can't be laid down because the organizing bit is gone, you know?
It's funny. It reminds me of hard disks. I don't know if you've ever, Neil, I know you have a computer degree. I'm sure you'll remember this, but a hard disk in a computer fills from the inside out or whatever. But once it gets to the end and it's full, when you start deleting things, it just writes wherever the free memory is. So although you might want a Word document that's 27 kilobytes, but it only had 15 kilobytes of space at the end,
right.
And then it picked another 12 from anywhere. And then the hippocampus picks all of the bits up together and gives it back to you in your computer the way you want it. So there's a perfect analogy there.
There is an analogy there. There is. Now, of course, we've tried to compare the brain to a computer actually for a long time. And it's infinitely more complex than that. Yeah. There's one great experiment I mentioned in the book. They had to use these massive supercomputers to try and model one tiny piece of the brain for a very short time, and it took hours and hours to do that. It's the most powerful computer ever invented kind of thing couldn't really mimic the brain at all.
Wow.
So whatever's going on there, it's not a simple case of ones and zeros.
No.
Not the basis for the computer science, but you know what I mean? It's something much more complex. But they aren't bad analogies, because computers have memory as well, of course. So there's some comparison.
Thanks for pissing all over my degree there,
a good man.
This is biochemist. So you have
plus ones and zeros. You know.
That's pretty much what he said. I'm a winner, you're a loser. It's binary that way. Candle. So you've met Candle then?
I have, yes, yeah.
And is the thing about Austria, so he emigrates from Austria, obviously around the time of the war, just before the war. And when he wins the Nobel Prize, the Austrian, the head of state, is it the president or prime minister, rings him and goes,
yeah, the president, yeah.
Any chance you can kind of forgive us? And he knows he has a little bit of credit in the bank here, so he asks for something.
He does, but of course he got out of Austria because of the Nazis, you see. So, and there's a famous street in Austria named after a famous Nazi mayor of Vienna or whatever, you know, who Hitler was a friend of and mentions in Mein Kampf, for example. You know?
Wow.
So Kant goes, I tell you what, rename that street, he says. And then I might come back and we'll have a celebration. They rename the street. Yeah, they get rid of the Nazi's name.
Do they rename it after him or just a generic name?
No, generic name.
No, it's Eva Braun Avenue now. he was really outplayed there. You always have to insist on the detail. Always.
Do you know what the most amazing thing about all of this is? Is thinking now what we know, and I'm sure, Luke, you will probably attest to the fact that we know so little about the brain. However, we actually know so much about the brain when you go back in time and think about, because even when you go back to the Egyptians, and that's, you're going back thousands of years, but the fact that they don't even consider the brain, you know, of any value, then the Greeks through philosophers are going, well, maybe because it's close to our eyes, whatever, you know, like it's not that long ago that there's no understanding of the brain. And now, okay, yes, we're opening the first pages, but at least we understand, you know, human anatomy, we understand biology, we understand the chemicals, we understand so much. And I mean, lay people, not Luke O'Neill brain people, you know, myself, like we have a vague understanding of these electrical impulses and neurons and different parts of the brain controlling different behaviors. And it's incredible.
It is. And there has been huge advances, and the advances are coming thick and fast, by the way. And one of my predictions, not just me saying this, we will understand a lot more in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Right.
And the big holy, well, there's two holy grails. I always use that phrase. One is to crack these diseases, because we still can't really treat depression or schizophrenia properly. There's some therapies. There's a massive need for better medicines and better ways to approach that. And then the second thing is consciousness. Will we ever figure out how we can think about thinking about things or whatever, and what is consciousness? And that's the other big unknown. You know, it's very hard.
I've been saying to Neil through lots of these episodes that all I'm waiting for, Luke, is a chance to upload my unbelievably sexy consciousness out of this terrible meat sack of middle age. To put it into something that is worthy of it, a 22-year-old gym bunny that I can just upload my consciousness to him. And then once he gets a bit old, go to the next one. Yeah. Like, I need to live forever inside the bodies of better people than me.
It's only a matter of time.
Again, parasitic, Neil. Parasitic.
Yeah, I think he was thinking more of it was Dave's original Jaffa line. I need to live forever in the bodies of other people. What a truly odd man. So you're saying consciousness is really the holy grail. So I think I can improve on René Descartes.
Oh, yeah.
I think, therefore I am.
Oh, no.
Surely that's a little bit better.
Well, did he not just streamline that even better, Neil, when he just took out the think? I mean, you think about thinking you think, but you think about everything else as well.
No, you just said think a few times there to confuse everybody. Shut up.
Fair.
I have one last question. I frankly didn't understand this bit. It was about optogenetics.
Yes. But
a line jumped in. Well, you like it because there's a certain pioneer of this field who's described as the Michael Jordan of neuroscience.
Oh,
yeah. Cool. And I met him as well, but I met them all. I can name drop the cows come home here. I met this guy, Carl Dieseroff.
For a minute there, I thought Luke O'Neill met Michael Jordan. I was like, oh my God, I'm literally wearing a Jordan t-shirt on me right now.
Yeah,
but you're doing biochemist levels of name drops. Nobody else has ever heard of that, man.
Nobody gives a monkey's, literally.
No. But he can, like, you can, this is the sentence that jumped out. You can insert a false memory into a mouse.
You can. Terrifying.
How?
Well, they still don't know, and it is a problem. But what he realized was, could you get neurons firing in different parts of the brain in a very controlled way?
Mm.
Yeah.
And optogenetics is a very fancy word. You actually put a gene into the brain of an animal, right? And that gene makes a protein that you can stimulate with a laser. Isn't that incredible?
Wow.
And that laser fires off the protein, and now the electrical impulses go down a certain track, and you can measure all that in real time, basically. Before all these are odd, you had to cut the mouse open and stick electrodes.
Sure,
in.
Yeah.
This is a living mouse. It's normal. What it lives in a cage. You know, you take the mouse out, zap the brain with the laser, and stuff happens. That's the best way to put it. And what he noticed was, in certain parts of the brain, he could induce a memory by zapping a certain part of the brain, a false.
Oh my
God. In other words, the mouse would remember where the cheese was, even though they haven't learned where the cheese is.
Yeah, so it's a basic memory. It's not like a mouse goes, I was a young child growing up in Bohemia. I collected butterflies. Like, it's not some really detailed.
The streets of Sofia were a rough place for a mouse like me.
That would be absolutely amazing. The past lives of a mouse that's only 2 years.
Luke, can I use this to my advantage? Can I insert a memory through firing a laser beam at my wife's head to make her forget how many guitars I own? That would be amazing.
You convince your wife. Okay, we talked to Arthur Cummings, right, who was the eye surgeon.
Yeah.
Right? So you convince her that she has to go and get laser corrective eye surgery, right? You get him to slightly move the eye to one side, zap the part of the brain, the guitar campus, right? She will forget you even have one guitar. It'll all work out. Now, I have to check one thing with you. I don't know if I've told the story on the show before, but it's your story. I've certainly asked your permission to tell it. That somebody from the Nobel Prize Committee once rang you and went, this is Hans Lundström from the Nobel Prize Committee. And Luke goes, oh my fucking God.
Is it? Finally.
Yeah, he puts down the
I'm going to be the Michael Jordan.
Puts on some underpants. Woohoo!
Yeah. Drop the monkey.
Drop the monkey.
And then they said, what? We want you to be a referee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Now, first of all, it was in August, so I kind of knew it's normally October.
Right.
I said to him, you're a bit early ringing me. He said, no, Professor O'Neill, we'd like you to referee this year's Nobel Prize. Give us your opinion. And I thought, well, isn't this great? And I'm thinking, it's like we're having a party. You're not invited, but who would you invite was the kind of question.
Or would you, hey, I want you to come to the party. Oh, great. Yeah, to put the music on in the background and then head out the back door so no one can see
Maybe
it.
Maybe give people cocktail sausages, you know, a few cannabis. Is it true also that your mate was offered 200 grand for a sperm?
He was. The guy who won it, yeah, actually. So two of my scientific mates won the Nobel. I wrote their reports, of course. It's
amazing.
Not like who you know, but
yeah,
and they were fantastic scientists. And I met him soon after and I said to him, what's it like, you know? And he was actually from Strasbourg. He was a very formal French kind of fella. You won't believe it, he says, I've been offered €200,000 for a sperm sample. And it was some clinic, you know, that has sperm on tap, as it were, whatever.
Right,
it is, you know. And I said to him, I tell you what, his name is Jules Hoffman, by the way. I tell you what, I said, I'll provide the sperm and split the money. How about that?
Yeah, but also, didn't he say it's not mine you want because it's my dad's?
It's my father. He's a taxi driver in Strasbourg. Yeah, he said it's my dad's sperm you want. It was his sperm that gave rise to the.
No, you don't want a taxi driver's sperm.
Yes,
you don't want a taxi driver's sperm because it will not go straight to the egg. It'll go off round via the airport. Oh, there's a charge. Oh, we have to go down via the fallopian tubes. That's not how you go. Listen, I know a shortcut. You end up in the lymph system and then eventually you get to the egg.
Jules, of course, never admitted that he got the money. However, he did rock up to the next scientific meeting in two Lamborghinis in a fur coat and a crown going, I don't know. It's just a Nobel Prize.
Bonjour. Je suis le Michel Jordan de Neuroscience. Luke O'Neill, it's been an absolute pleasure. If you want to read more of Luke's, I was going to say ramblings, but scientifically based ramblings and loads of little anecdotes in there as well that elevate everything as well. To boldly go where no book has gone before. A joyous journey through all of science. And do you know who, Dave, if you wrote a book, you'd ask me to write a little bit on the back, wouldn't you?
Yeah, a little endorsement or something, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know who Luke has? Bono.
You don't have Bono.
He has Bono.
I do.
Jesus.
I hate to admit it. Yeah, yeah.
He has Bono.
That's
and
astounding.
It says, he is treating me very well. Please, please do not harm my family. This
is
book is quite good.
Of October.
And there's a picture of him holding up a newspaper.
Luke, that is honestly one of the most fascinating episodes we've done ever. Thank you so much.
Very good. Great fun. Thanks, Neil. Thanks, Dave.
Well, welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That, Dave. Luke O'Neill is such a good communicator, isn't he?
I mean, like, to be a professor and to be that eloquent, entertaining and talented, the man's a musician, he's so informed, he's at the cutting edge of science. This guy's incredible.
Yeah, and that's just a small part of the book, obviously, because I was reading the whole book, and you just have to try and pick a bit to hone in on and focus in on. So I thought the brain was where we should start, given that we've been looking for hours for five series now, and there's been no sign of it.
No,
but yeah,
no.
What weird things lead to the expansion of human knowledge?
That
anyway,
is amazing. Yeah.
Talking of expansion of human knowledge, what have you got for me next week?
Well, Neil, I have enlisted the help of a shark expert to explore these incredible animals. Do they sleep? Do they eat their siblings in the womb? And how many teeth can they actually have throughout their whole lifetime?
Ooh.
Yep.
Now, that is right in my wheelhouse. I can't wait for that.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.